Mornings in Jenin by Susan Abulhawa is the story of one Palestinian family over four generations. The story begins with the Abul Hejja family at their home in the village of Ain Hud, near Haifa. In 1948, the family is forced from their ancestral home and goes to live in a refugee camp in Jenin. Susan Abulhawa is the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, an NGO that builds playgrounds for Palestinian children in the occupied territories and refugee camps elsewhere. Mornings in Jenin marks her first major fiction publication. Malihe Razazan spoke with Susan about how she tells the story of Palestine in her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin.
The characters themselves, the personalities, are fictitious, but they are based on a real way of life, so to speak. You know, the way they live, the simplicity, the farming life, the olive harvest, that would be representative of a typical Fallahin family. Fallahin just means,
peasant.
Right. Fallahin actually is often translated as peasant, mm-hmm. but it's not quite that. The Fallahin people are indeed considered, the peasantry class, but it specifically refers to people who tilled the land, people who lived off of the land. And so they're referred to as peasants, but they're not necessarily just peasants in the way that you would think of in Western terms. And for the Fallahin, the land was everything. The harvest was everything. And, when you talk to a lot of the older generation that lives in the refugee camp still, the ones who did live that life, when they start going down memory lane and they speak nostalgically about their memories, always they will talk about their trees. They will talk about, there was a real connectedness and a real living dynamic relationship between farmers and their land and their groves. And, oftentimes people regarded trees in particular as almost like members of the family. They could tell you when they planted this tree, what happened when they planted it, when they planted the one next to it, all kinds of family histories and stories that are often connected to particular plants, to particular trees. And it's really extraordinary to listen to these stories and to see how much the natural surroundings comes into play in their memories of, the people and their families, but always there's an element of nature that will creep into various family stories.
How much of this history did you yourself know before starting on the journey of writing this book?
I certainly have my own family's history. Mm-hmm. Both my grandmothers spoke in those kinds of nostalgic terms about the trees and their land and the hills. But I've been to a lot of refugee camps, and I've spoken a lot to that generation. I've also done quite a bit of academic research as well to really understand and get a feel for what life was like back then, what it was like particularly for the Fallahin, and also what life was like in the city, in Jerusalem and Haifa and so forth. So it was really important to me that aspects of the book, whether it's historic events, whether it's, native flora, seasons, weather pattern, location, that all of these things be firmly grounded in reality and in history.
The characters, mm-hmm. as you said, are fictional and the locations are real. This is not autobiographical. But there is another section in this book called The Orphanage.
Yes.
And I was reading that was your experience. You were in this orphanage in Jerusalem. Can you talk a little bit about that in sense of how much of this book is really you and how much of it is based on a historical Palestinian experience?
The Orphanage is the only chapter that is truly autobiographical. And yes, and that does reflect the 3 years that I lived in Dar al-Tifl al-Arabi.
And how did you end up there?
My family, like all Palestinian families who became refugees, was scattered. And I won't really get into this long-storted, story of my family, but suffice it to say that I pretty much kind of fell through the cracks. It wasn't all the war. There were, a lot of family issues, but my parents were still living, but I did end up in this orphanage for girls where I lived. And then subsequently, when I came to the U.S., I grew up in foster care in North Carolina. And this is something that's, unique to Palestinians, this kind of disconnectedness from families. Most Arabs in the Middle East live within and around huge extended families. I mean, it is quite unusual for people to be so mobile, so far away from their grandparents and their grandkids and their cousins and so forth. I mean, that's the social infrastructure throughout the Middle East. And with Palestinian families who suddenly became landless, homeless, and penniless, they had to go, each member had to go and seek their fortunes elsewhere. And so those of us who ended up in exile became very fragmented and disconnected from each other.
Susan, I want to move on and speak about your novel, of course, but I'm just curious, were you able to connect to your extended family?
You know, I know them, of course. I know, you know, most of my cousins and so forth, but to say that, you know, I truly connect, no, that I don't. I mean, I even have, you know, 5 sisters who live in Kuwait. I never, you know, I didn't really grow up with them. I've visited them over the years, and I don't really have, actually with my parents, I don't really have much of a relationship either.
This book starts back in the 40s, but then comes the Nakba, or catastrophe of 1948, when Palestinians were forced out of their homes.
Mm-hmm.
So the family ends up in Jenin refugee camp. And as the family is leaving their home, on the way one of the sons, Yusuf's brother, is stolen. We find out during the course of the novel that he's being raised in a Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is David.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you choose to introduce this story, which does not run in a way parallel to the main plot? But we don't hear much about him. We hear about him sporadically through the lives of his adopted family,
mm-hmm.
except towards the end of the book. In a way, when I was reading this, we're not going to give away the ending of the book,
mm-hmm.
but when I was reading this book, he sort of symbolized Palestine for me, that in 1948, he was stolen, he was taken away,
mm-hmm.
and he was given a Jewish identity, an mm-hmm. Israeli identity. And then we later on, during, you know, the course of your novel, we find out exactly how he comes back and connects to the rest of the Palestinian characters in this novel. What does David mean to you? Why did you put him there?
That's a very good question. They were brothers, certainly, but Yusuf was older. So I'm glad that you recognize that the story of David is not the main, it's not the main story. But for some reason, most people who read this novel are intrigued by that concept that when they describe the book, they describe it in terms of this initial kidnapping. And so the idea of a Palestinian child growing up in a Jewish family to become a soldier who then opposes his family is an intriguing concept. It's an intriguing literary concept as well. You are right. To me, David was a symbol. In many ways, he's not only a symbol of what has happened to Palestine. He is a symbol of Israel in some ways, because a lot of, you know, to me, Israel is made up. Certainly, there is a group, you know, Jewish history is deeply rooted in Palestine, as is Christian history, as is Islamic history. Jewish history is deeply rooted in Egypt. It is deeply rooted in Iraq as well. But the whole notion that these Europeans who came to Palestine themselves were deeply rooted in that land is made up, and it's fictitious. And there is this made-up identity that they have, this myth that all these people from Russia, from Ethiopia, are somehow native to Palestine. That's absolutely false. It's scientifically false. You know, they are not the natives of that land. And so,
historically,
absolutely. So this, in addition to David representing this whole identity, his whole identity crisis is not only reflective of what has happened to Palestine, but also what has happened to what is the idea that Israel's kind of made up. And David he didn't know who he was. You know, he wasn't really Israeli. He wasn't really, he was a native to the land, but not really as an Israeli Jew.
Yeah, and his family were trying to keep the truth from him.
Exactly. And he was greatly harmed as a result.
Amal,
mm-hmm.
which means hope.
Amal, yeah.
She's the narrator of this novel.
Mm-hmm.
And there is one part in the book where Youssef, after 1967, he becomes politically active and he joins the resistance. He becomes a member of PLO, and he gets arrested and he put in jail.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you write, within 6 months, Youssef had endured torture and random beating that had marked nearly every part of his body. He had been forced to strip before women, and his student had been made to kiss the feet of a soldier who had threatened to beat a small boy if Youssef did not kneel. Most men had endured such treatment. Most were broken, and most had returned from the humiliation with violent tempers aimed at their wives or sisters or children. How much of this experience, especially the part that you write about humiliation with violent tempers aimed at their wives or sisters or children, resonates with what Palestinian political prisoners are going through today?
Well, first of all, you know, that small example of Youssef forcing to kiss the feet of a soldier, lest the soldier be a small boy, that's actually something that really happened. It's, something that I came across in a report during my research. And this kind of daily humiliations is very well documented by human rights organizations. I mean, this is no big secret. You Palestinians live by the whims of 18-year-old soldiers at checkpoints who are bored, who are riddled with testosterone and aggression and disrespect and really hatred of Palestinians. So, you know, what happens at these checkpoints is horrendous, and people are slapped around, they're beaten, they're humiliated, they are emasculated, they're belittled, they are treated as animals, you know, they're certainly not treated as human beings, and they're certainly not treated with respect. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but I do know that kind of treatment often, when men in particular feel completely impotent and emasculated, they do turn to someone weaker than them to make themselves feel powerful again. And unfortunately, this happens. It happens in societies all over the world, and it does happen in Palestine. And,
yeah.
And so there is this aggression. And by children as well. Children often play with each other in a very aggressive way. And this is bred by, you know, the violence that's around them.
I have seen a couple of reports regarding the rise in violence against women
mm-hmm.
in the occupied territories. In December of 2009, a report by the Gaza-based Palestinian Women's
mm-hmm.
Information and Media Center
mm-hmm.
noted an upsurge in violence against women
mm-hmm.
since Israel imposed its economic blockade
mm-hmm.
on the Gaza Strip. And also the Palestinian Women's Center for Law and Counseling recently released a report on the specific impact of Israeli occupation and human rights abuses on women in the occupied territories.
It's not surprising that there would be a rise in domestic violence. Palestinian women have been, a woman is in every society, and in Palestinian society, certainly the rock of the family. But when you can't feed your children, when your husband is idle and he's completely impotent, when you are unable to protect your children, as many Gazan families have experienced, it destroys you. It destroys the family. It destroys the basic glue that holds families together in a way. And it's, you love each other, but you are so powerless to do anything for each other. And, you know, for men, sometimes men, unfortunately, and not always, but they do become violent towards their wives. And the women then endure, you know, not only what the rest of the family is enduring, but everything falls on them a little bit more than the rest. But I do want to say something about this, because I don't like to concentrate on that, because, you know, one of the reviewers of this novel, I think it was in the UK.
Mm.
She actually focused on that line where I said, you know, the men often returned from the humiliation with violent tempers aimed at their wives and children. She focused on that, and she was really upset quite with the novel because I did not elaborate on that. And in her eyes, in this reviewer's eyes, the novel seemed unrealistic that Palestinians, that the characters in this novel could remain essentially good. it was as if she needed validation to show that, yeah, these really are very violent people, and she needed to see Palestinians being more violent, because that's what the world expects us. That's how they see us, and they want validation that, yes, that's how we are. But in fact, Palestinians have lived this horrendous injustice for 60 years. You know, the fabric of our society has changed so much. The fabric of our families, our family structures have changed so much. I did mention the example of, you know, those of us who live in the diaspora, how we're shattered. But those of us who live under constant violence, when you walk through the Palestinian territories and you watch children play, all the kids, they always almost invariably will play Palestinian and Israeli soldier, kind of like, you know, cowboys and Indians. Mm-hmm. And all the kids always want to be the Israeli soldier. They want to be the one with the power. They want to be the one holding the gun, interrogating the Palestinian, slapping him around. And these are very violent games. And it seems to me that human nature, they all want to be the ones with the power. We all want to feel that we have power over our own lives and our own destiny. Yeah. And in the eyes of these children, the only ones who can really steer their destinies are the ones with the guns.
Talking about power, something that struck me reading your novel was the female characters in your book, Dalia, Fatima, and Amal, as I said, who's the main narrator of your book. They were very unique. Fatima was a Bedouin.
Mm-hmm.
Dalia was quite an amazing woman in terms of how she related to Amal. How did you develop your female characters?
I have to say this, and this might sound strange, but when I sat down to write this novel, I didn't have a plan and I didn't have an outline. The only thing I honestly knew about the story was that there were going to be two brothers who would meet up. You know, they would be separated at birth and they would meet up in the 67 war. And as I started to write, most of the characters initially were stick figures who were speaking in my angry voice. But with more and more iterations, the characters started to fill out, to have take their own personalities, and in many ways, they told their own stories. I don't know how else to describe it except that they really came alive and they told their own stories. I just wanted to, as honestly as possible, just tell their stories. For example, in the early part of the book, Dalia passes away. She dies. And I intended for her to be a rather minor character, but she haunted the entire book, and actually she was easily my favorite character.
And Fatima also was an extreme, I mean, she was such a refreshing character in your novel. In a way, she kind of shaped Yusuf.
Yeah.
It turns him into this very optimistic, upbeat character. What did Fatima mean to you when you were writing this novel?
Fatima, to me, was the quintessential falaha girl who's idealistic and believes in love above all. She falls in love with Yusuf, and it really is her love that rescues him. It's not that he's shaped by her love, because he is, but she saves him. And she was a simple girl from simple and humble beginnings, and she had the very deep wisdom that somehow only people who are very close to the earth, very close to their own hearts and very close to love can really come up with. She wasn't terribly sophisticated and worldly, but she was quite wise, I think.
Amal, she spends a few years in a orphanage in Jerusalem, and then she wins a scholarship and she ends up in United States, in Philadelphia. So how much of Amal's life parallels yours, Susan?
Yeah, and I guess it does in some ways.
Because she ends up being a single mother too.
Yeah. In some ways, I think most writers, you know, can only really write what we really truly understand and feel in our hearts. And more of myself actually came out of this book than I had intended. But I guess that's, you know, I guess that's just what happens when you write a book. So, yeah, I understood very viscerally what it means to leave your world and step into a completely foreign world with really no support around you. And, you know, that was a profound thing in my life, and I suppose it was quite natural that I would go in that direction, although I like I said, I didn't really have plans to, but that's where the story took me. So, yeah, I guess there are a lot of parallels between myself and Ahmad. I think that, you know, the mother-daughter relationship in my life has been hugely impactful. You know, first my relationship with my mother and then my relationship with my daughter later on. And I think even though, you know, my experience is very different than what Ahmad and her daughter lived through in the book, it is nonetheless, it's one of, in my view, it's one of the more powerful threads throughout the book is that mother-daughter relationship.
As you say, there is this a strong thread of mother-daughter relationship, but it's always cut short.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't last for a long time.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, as a writer, like I said, that, you know, when something like that, that's been really a profound aspect of my life that has shaped, again, who I am, that in a way has been my experience. But, you know, the mother-daughter relationship, it is complicated, and it does seem to, even though it is cut short in some ways, it lingers, and it actually, even in the absence of one, or whether mother or the daughter, it remains the most powerful force in that woman's life, whether it's the mother or the daughter.
Susan, to conclude this conversation, would you like to leave us with one of your favorite passages in your book?
This is a little scene that occurs between Ahmad and her father when she's a small child. And it's when Ahmad kind of discovers her father. "Listen to the words I read. They're magical," he said. "And I tried very hard to understand the classical Arabic prose. But to my young mind, it seemed another language. Still, the cadence was mesmerizing, and Baba's voice was a lullaby. I dozed in his arms. I told no one of the incident, and I lived through the day in anticipation of night, the darkness just before dawn, hoping to once again have a special place in Baba's morning. I fit perfectly in Baba's lap. His arms circled and held me there, my head resting in the hollow of his shoulder. He read to me again. I could hear the turbulence inside Baba's chest, the protests of his lungs against each inhalation of honey apple tobacco. Baba, who do you love more, me or Yusuf? Habibti, he began. I couldn't help but smile when he called me that. I love you both the same, he said. How big do you love me? I love you as big as the ocean and all of its fishes, as big as the sky and all its birds, as big as the earth and all her trees. What about the universe and all its planets? You forgot that part. I was getting to it. Be patient, he said, puffing on his pipe. He exhaled. And I love you bigger than the universe and all its planets. Do you love Yusuf that much? Yes, as big as the ocean, but without all the fishes. My heart grew with all the fishes. The idea that Baba loved me just a little bit more. What about the sky and earth? Do you love him that big, but without all the birds and the trees? Yes, but don't tell anyone. I won't, Baba, I swear. My heart swelled with birds now. What about the universe part? Don't be greedy, he winked at me. I have to get to work, Habibti, tomorrow.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Malihe. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Susan Abulhawa is the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, an NGO that builds playgrounds for Palestinian children in the occupied territories and refugee camps elsewhere. Susan has contributed essays to the New York Daily News, Chicago Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, and Philadelphia Inquirer, among other publications, and Morning in Jenin marks her first major publications as a novelist. I am Malihe Razazan for Women's Magazine. Stay with us.
This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Erin Mathewson.
يا ليلي 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 يا ليلي